Hello and welcome to The World This Week with me, Gavin Lee, live in Paris every week with a panel of distinguished guests. Discussing the past 7 days, our programme now selected as one of the best 100 podcasts in the world for current affairs as well. So thank you for watching. In a week that marked President Trump's 100 days in office, National Security Advisor, who Mike Waltz, a very interesting week for him. He wasn't celebrating, and he was moved aside. The first cabinet casualty of the president's second term. In the fallout of Signalgate, when he accidentally added a journalist to its war planning group chat, we'll assess the 100 days and Trump's so-called muzzle velocity strategy, flooding the media space with continuous announcements, and perhaps comes as no surprise. He's given himself full marks.
This is the best, they say, 100-day start of any president in history, and everyone is saying it. We've just gotten started. You haven't even seen anything yet. It's all just kicking in.
It's seen a political comeback of the year so far, thanks partly to threats and trolling from President Trump. Canada's Liberal Party came out on top, despite being discarded by analysts as down and out at the start of the year. Tariffs and trade wars triggered by the neighbour and Trump's threats to annex them seem to help galvanise a patriotic pushback. Mark Carney's task was to distance himself from his predecessor, Justin Trudeau, while Conservative opposition leader Pierre Poilievre had to distance himself from claims of being a mini-Trump. Voters opted for the Liberal ex-banker Carney, who expressed his happiness at party headquarters through the form of dance. And it's been a rare week of good news in Ukraine, or that's how it's being presented by negotiators in Kyiv and Washington. A critical minerals deal has been concluded with the US, one that first was proposed by the Ukrainians to President Biden last autumn. It morphed under Trump into an IOU agreement, critical minerals for repayment of past US aid. After the Oval Office spat and Ukrainian hopes of a security guarantee out of the question, terms were dropped and better concessions agreed that Kyiv sees as a good deal, given the circumstances. We'll assess what it means for the conflict.
As President Trump presses to end this horrible war, he wants both sides to come to the table now by showing that the U.S. has an economic interest in Ukraine. It's a signal to the Russian leadership.
To my panelists joining me on tonight's programme, in London, Nina Dos Santos, journalist, former CNN anchor and correspondent, two-time winner of the prestigious Alfred Dupont Award for outstanding reporting, and now co-host of podcast Control Alt Deceit, Democracy in Danger. Good evening, Nina. Great to have you with us this evening. Your input, insight is of great value. You're into your second series now, and tell me about it. It's been investigating the underbelly of politics and looking at how, why, who is attempting to control the narrative.
Yeah, that's right, Gavin. Well, thank you very much for having me on the show. And also, thank you very much for mentioning this important initiative that, you know, we're now into our second series of. We've explored everything from sort of dark money, disinformation campaigns that are continuing to undermine our democracies around the world. And we've also started out the series just before the US President Donald Trump was elected at the start of November 2024. And boy, have things changed in the 100 days that he's been in office and also the run-up to this turbulent second Trump presidency.
Let's take a look, Nina. This is a snippet of your trailer for Control Alt Deceit.
What future is there now for the opposition?
There is no oxygen whatsoever for Russian opposition. Either they're dead, they're in jail, or they're in exile.
People inside the country barely know what a democracy is.
Isn't it funny? You all laughed at me. Well, I have to say, you're not laughing now, are you?
If Elon Musk were to give $100 million to Nigel Farage, what would your government do? Would you stop it?
Well, I think we should change the rules as soon as possible.
Is that democratic?
Nina, it's quite serendipitous, perhaps, hearing Nigel Farage as part of your trail saying, no, you're all laughing at me, no one's laughing now, especially today, given the election results where you are in the UK.
Absolutely. I'm so glad that you picked up on that. So Nigel Farage's party, the Reform Party, has now won a by-election that happened just this week in Runcorn. That was a crucial Labour Party seat. And they've also won a mayoral election with a huge majority there from the Conservatives too. So the point that he's making here is that he's been able to translate his one-time Brexit message when he was over in Brussels, and you and I both covered the Brussels beat in years gone by, Gavin, to a national political movement in the United Kingdom. And what it is doing is it's smashing the two-party, if not three-party system that we've had over the last part of my generation and turning it into a four- and five-party system in the UK. And that is the big discourse here this week after those local elections, with Reform taking seats not just from the Conservatives and council seats as well, but also from Labour too. It's a two-pronged attack.
Mm-hmm. Very, very interesting and great to have you here. So Control Alt the Seat, a podcast. I've got to say, it's rare you get a five-star rating online. So well done on that, Nina. Fantastic that you're with us. Here in the studio, we have seasoned international journalist Emma Kate Simmons, Paris-based columnist at The New European, editor of the weekly publication Franc Tireur, a.k.a. Sharpshooter. Freethinker, Emma, pleasure to have you with us tonight.
Thank you.
I want to talk about something, which is your article this week on Steve Witkoff. Let's have a look at your headline. I think I'm right to say the world's worst negotiator. Tell us about that.
Sure. Actually, that line does come from John Bolton, who was a key figure in the first Trump administration, represented the Trump administration in the United Nations. And he made that absolute point that he has absolutely no diplomatic experience. But even worse than that, he's a real estate developer and a golfing buddy of Donald Trump's. They've been friends for 40 years. What's most important about Steve Witkoff is the fact that he's enmeshed in the Trump family and with Trump money. So World Liberty Financial, the crypto outfit that Witkoff and his son set up last year with the Trump sons, it has now made hundreds of millions of dollars already in March this year. So Trump trusts this man. He sends him off to speak to Vladimir Putin. But the worst thing about him is that he's not only a bad diplomat, he goes in to meet the president of Russia without a translator. And he takes the translators from the Kremlin. Often he's been called a patsy, and he was even called a bumbling effing idiot this week in a report that cited unnamed sources from the White House that was in the New York Post.
Well, he did this very, very long interview, didn't he? 3-hour interview with Tucker Carlson, where he talks, he kind of said a mea culpa at the beginning. I was quixotic. I thought I was going to come in with a, you know, knight in shining armour and solve the situation in the Middle East. Then Ukraine, it's got a bit more complicated, from his own words. I want to also mention to you an area that's often overlooked, his relationship with, and you talk about this in your piece, this is Len Blavatnik. He's a billionaire, born in the former Soviet Union, now a US-UK citizen. They've developed high end real estate together. Is it a potentially conflicting dynamic?
Absolutely. I mean, I think it tells you everything you need to know about the Trump administration and the cronies surrounding Donald Trump. So Blavatnik has three nationalities. He's British, he's Russian, but he's also American. And he's been doing deals for years, Florida real estate deals with Steve Witkoff. So how can we possibly not think that when Steve Witkoff goes to Moscow and he's been there a couple of times, he's met Putin 4 times, that he's not also working on all of this on the side, if not at the heart. And we're also hearing that Donald Trump may be well moving towards a Trump Tower or hotel in Moscow, in the Emirates, and also in Qatar. Qatar, he's also very close to Qatar, Steve Witkoff. So he's like, as we wrote, Donald Trump's clone, but with less bite. You know, he comes across as a little bit more affable, but a lot of people think he's idiotic. Like when he came to the Elysee Palace and met Emmanuel Macron and started to say that it looked like Mar-a-Lago, Trump's Florida gaudy mansion.
Yes, I remember the meeting very well. Now, it turns out Len Blavatnik is a reader of The New European, is he?
He is, and we did receive some contact from. He does deny, not that we. He says he's not close to Putin. Okay. And he doesn't say he's an oligarch, but he has been sanctioned by Ukraine in 2023. He's extremely sensitive about that. The question is, why has he not been sanctioned by Europe and the United States? Well, the United States is lifting sanctions, as it did temporarily on Kirill Dmitriev, who is the head of the Russian Sovereign Fund, who was sent to Washington to also try and nut out a deal. And sanctions were lifted on him in order for that to happen. But
Very interesting. So the sense from the Ukraine, quote, individuals posing a threat to national security, you say, is not sanctioned in the UK, EU or the US, and he denies links to Russian oligarchs. Great to have you with us.
Thank you.
Kate. Also on our lineup tonight, a great friend of the programme, another well-travelled, long-time European correspondent, Ana Navarro Pedro, Paris-based reporter for Portuguese media. Ana, great to have you here with us. It has been an extraordinary week on the Iberian Peninsula. We saw this sudden power outage, didn't we, in Spain and Madrid. People told it was too dangerous to even drive. Tell us about, well, the actual incident itself and what we know to have caused it.
Well, the incident itself, as you know, people were caught totally unawares. Beginning, they thought maybe 1 hour, 2 hours, and they realized it wasn't. It was going to be very long. They started panicking because people are quite aware that power cuts may come into, you know, this very troubled, insecure world we live in. So in Spain, in Portugal, I know people who did go to the bank and took as much money as they could because there were nothing, no computers, nothing working, but there were some forms that could be filled by hand with a pen. Remember that? the fun fact also was, if there was one, because there was tragedy as well, hospitals, people not going to breathe, and people caught in lifts and so forth, but there were fun facts as well, people going to the small shops, you know, foreigners and buying little radios with batteries, you know, because it was the only way to be informed. And by the way, to everybody in each country, there are contingency measures to inform people, the population, via radio and so you need a transistor with batteries if you don't have internet, even if you don't have electricity.
And it threads back, doesn't it, to the EU advice recently to people, say, survival kit for 48 hours. And one of those bits of survival kit was the radio.
Absolutely. And have some torch lamp as well, because, you know, you should not spend all the battery on your smartphone with your light.
Well, I've never seen people so happy to see a light switched on. Let's have a look at this. Is Madrid in the evening when suddenly the lights came back. And also with us, Doug Herbert, France 24's international affairs commentator, who began his journalism, Doug, with post-Soviet Russia, writing for the New York Times and the Moscow Bureau in the 90s. So fair to say Vladimir Putin has been living rent-free in your head for decades, Doug.
Live and breathe him every single day, yeah. But I was there before Putin, though. So there was a Russia, believe it or not, before Vladimir Putin.
We may explore that this evening. Doug, great to have you on board as well. To the Macomb College Sports and Expo Center in the center of Warren, Michigan, a mecca for the MAGA movement, and where President Trump chose to celebrate his first 100 days of his second presidency. The first rally since his inauguration and a return to campaign-style format. New MAGA merch on sale too, including 100 Days of Greatness t-shirts, mugs, posters with the Golden Age printed on. The official Trump store also released a red cap with the words Trump 28, $50 a hat, modeled by the family. Well, during a 90-minute speech, his themes were, there it is, familiar, immigration, tariffs, grievances against political rivals. And clips were shown of the maximum security prison in El Salvador, a justification of why Trump sent alleged Venezuelan gang members there using antiquated laws not seen since the Second World War. A land of milk and honey promised to those inside, including for the economy, despite new figures out this week that show the GDP shrunk by 0.3% for the first quarter. Biden overhang claimed the White House. Give it time. In the streets outside, the message was hands off from the estimated 3,000 protesters who flew inverted U.S. flags, you should say, traditionally a sign of distress, extreme danger in the States. Let's hear from Donald Trump.
As a result of our policies, for the first time in modern history, more Americans believe that our country is headed in the right direction than the wrong direction. They have a poll, a crazy poll, probably a fake poll, too, so I don't know, I don't care. But first time ever, I think ever, that they're saying the country is headed in the right direction. Has never happened before.
Well, it wasn't the first time ever. There was, I'm sure, be not surprised to know, to fact check, there were three polls out, and one of the polls suggested that 46% of the public believed that the US was going in the right direction. The other two said 26 and 36. So none of those were the majority. But still, Nina, let's start with you. What struck you most about the first 100 days of the whirlwind? What stands out the most, do you think?
I think the obvious thing is that, you know, tariffs have been slapped on all sorts of countries, including allies and huge trading partners of the United States. Mm-hmm. And first of all, there were some concerns that, you know, the economic rationale behind this hadn't been very well thought through. Then there were some concerns by academics who apparently this whole tariff policy is based upon, saying, well, look, I think they might have got the maths wrong. And then, of course, you have huge concerns from big trading partners like the European Union, who perhaps have been planning for this moment for some time, but perhaps not well enough. And then, of course, you have China, the second biggest economy in the world now, that is making it very, very clear that it is not willing to buckle here. So you effectively have a trade embargo between the two largest economies in the world. And that is a problem not just for the US and the US consumer further down the line, and a problem for the Chinese worker pumping out all of those cheap goods from their factories. It's a problem for everyone else around the rest of the world, because it could plunge the world into a recession or a depression from here.
It's a very good point, and we're seeing that today as well. So not just 145% tariffs on China and 125% the other way, but this kind of loophole that was there before for smaller businesses, those that are selling products under $800 worth of goods, which was kind of duty-free before, now no longer the case. So fast fashion outlets like Shein and Temu feeling the brunt of that, putting their prices up or stopping direct sales. Emma, listening to Nina, one thing that strikes me is just you're kind of catching a moment in the whirlwind. That's kind of the deliberate strategy that it's been. We know this muzzle velocity that Steve Bannon talked about. I want to quote something to you. This is Paul Danz, a man who was associated for Trump for a while, the former director of Project 2025 that Doug spoke about before. He said this about Trump's first 100 days. He said, it's the first moment the presidency has to seize. He says, quote, there's almost a decay after that, like a battery losing life. And he certainly sees those first 100 days, hasn't he?
Sure. I mean, it's shock and autocracy, shock and awfulness. And yes, it was all laid out there in that Project 2025 terribly far-right document that also drew a lot upon the model of Viktor Orban in Hungary and other autocrats, and certainly the first 100 days. But what struck me, apart from the awfulness in relation to the economy and Trump starting to crash the dollar, at least sending it down from a high of 98 cents to the euro to where it is at 88, the bond market in crisis, sell-offs of US treasuries, plus all the tariffs, inflation going up. It's pretty bad news, except today I noticed that with some jobs reports out of 177,000 jobs having been added, there has been a rally on markets back to their Day of Liberation April 2 level. But on the autocracy factor, I think the biggest, perhaps it's not a surprise, but it's the attack on the Constitution and the judiciary, to see the head of the FBI, ministers going out and arresting judges, threatening to arrest more and to put them in jail for doing their job and for not respecting the independence of the judiciary, including the Supreme Court, which is dominated by Donald Trump appointees. Donald Trump is ignoring, in his administration, rulings from the Supreme Court and from other courts, notably when it comes to the deportation of so-called gang members who've been picked up by these ICE agents, immigration agents in the street, like in a totalitarian society. The images are totalitarian, and I don't think we can underplay that. And I think historians like Timothy Snyder and others who have even left the United States are making it very clear, Anne Applebaum, her book on autocracy, that that's where the US is headed, and maybe it's already there, because look at the evidence.
Doug, let me bring you in this. First of all, if we look at what Emma Kaye is saying, this kind of stretches overreach of executive presidential power.
Testing the limits.
Two issues there bring up, many, but actually just to take two of them from it. One is kind of the arrest of a so-called anti-Semitic extremists, protesters at universities, students. And one of them was released this week without charge. He was told by the judge this was unlawful, essentially. It shouldn't have been held for 2 weeks. But trying to correct the path of the universities, and also the detention and the deportation of those two Venezuelan alleged gang members to El Salvador, the Trump administration saying that these are terrorists, this is an attack on the country using old laws. The point being, the Supreme Court in that case hasn't told him directly, has it yet,
no,
to bring them back. So therefore, he can claim this is not expansion of my own power.
The Supreme Court hasn't actually spoken with clarity on anything, even in the case of the mistakenly, I'm using a moderate term here, mistakenly deported Mantel Salvatore to the Maryland father. Even there, the Supreme Court said, please, you know, you should facilitate his return. You could interpret that almost any way you want. You facilitate it doesn't mean you actually have to make sure it's executed. Donald Trump has obviously been able to always do an end run, as the Americans might say, around the ambiguity in a lot of these orders. It's not to say that the Supreme Court is openly doing Donald Trump's bidding, but its rulings to date, I think there's been five or six of them, you know, because a lot of things still remain in flux on a lower court level. It's very clear that the Supreme Court has worded its rulings in a way that allow Trump and his allies, you might call them minions, allies, whatever, supporters, are able to sort of work with. And I mean that in a very liberal way. It's a constant, relentless barrage of actions by which he is pushing the limits, testing the limits of constitutional norms, pressing the limits of executive power, basically a demolition derby of the other branches of government. Mm-hmm. You know, we all sit here and we talk about there are three branches of government. We all, you know, in U.S. schools growing up, this is, you know, it's drilled into us and it almost becomes sort of part of the ecosystem. You assume they're all there. And then all of a sudden, it's like what Timothy Schneider said, and we keep quoting him, you know, autocracies don't happen overnight, right? It's an incremental drip by drip, step by step thing. And all of a sudden you look around and you realize, wait, where'd they go? And that's it. Those checks, those guardrails have, in that brief period of time, even without us not being able to explicitly say, well, they're gone, because they're still there. There's still courts, there's still judges, there's still a Congress, it's still sitting in session, it's still doing things technically, but it's not as much there as it was 100 days ago on January 20th. None of those other branches are as much there.
Which is an interesting point, Anna, as well, because the other issue is, if you look at all of the polling, if you look at all the analysis, and his opinion polls are dropping, but it doesn't seem from the analysis that I've seen that voters, particularly his base, and we've got kind of a split screen reaction here, those that love what he's doing and those that see, as we're discussing, the holes here, that they're not losing sleep over these issues that Doug's talking about and Emma Kate's talking about.
No, because they haven't been hit yet.
It's the economy.
It's the economy. The autocracy side of his ruling, it's nothing that upsets them because they want authority, actually, in government. They don't realize that institutions are very fragile. And as Doug was saying, they depend on, actually, that's what I say, they depend on people and on the people who are running them. So they haven't realized it. They are going, the curiosity is to see how they're going to react in about 4 to 7 weeks' time. According to experts, there are 7 weeks of stock in the United States, you know, all the things coming from China as well, that all the base, the voters on Trump can buy at Walmart and other, you know, not so expensive stores. So that's when we'll see if things are going to hit it or not, to his popularity is going to drop or not. And that will be the real test. If he passes that test, I believe, as many historians have been saying, warning in the United States, that then democracy will be dead in the United States by then.
Well, you touch upon something that's, I think it gets to the heart of this, Nina, as well, doesn't it? It's, and Doug said it before, this kind of end strategy, the constant communication, which other leaders, I think, are learning lessons from around the world. He's changed the game in terms of a communication strategy, hasn't he? That the manner, the speed of communication, the fact that Anna was talking a moment ago, Nina, about the economy. He talks all the time of eggs, doesn't he? He talks about the gas being cheaper. He goes away from those issues. He goes to the macro rather than the micro on it. I just wonder how you think that affects the whole political, perhaps international landscape.
Well, it's quite clear that Donald Trump is trying to depress the US dollar. He wants to weaken it because he wants US goods to become more competitive as soon as possible. He wants to be able to try and use that as a tactic to try and beef up the US economy because it's obviously been buffeted by the swiftness of this trade policy that he's implemented, alienating all of those trading partners around the world. And as you pointed out earlier on the show, that has sent the economy plunging in the first quarter, albeit just one quarter. But the Democrats are poised and ready on his back to say that if it's two quarters in a row, he's plunged the biggest economy in the world that was very robust until before his election into a recession. Is that going to happen? I don't know. But the oil price has also been coming down and been quite depressed for some time. I mean, that might also be, you know, a tactic to try and get Vladimir Putin to the negotiating table over Ukraine. Obviously, a lower oil price for quite some time would irk a big ally of America, Saudi Arabia. So they might get tetchy about this. But this could be part of the sort of two-pronged strategy economically of Donald Trump, alongside his sort of sucker punch to many of those big trading partners to try and get them to invest and make their goods in America rather than making them in China and then selling them over to America like, say, you know, European Union countries do. All of this, though, I think is fanciful thinking because the timings won't necessarily work out. I've been speaking to many CEOs of big businesses who say, well, look, the problem is the midterms are coming around the corner. The Economist magazine had a front page just a week or so ago with a picture of a beleaguered American eagle losing its feathers, saying, just 1,369 days to go. That isn't a great investment policy if you're planning on reshoring jobs to America and building factories that'll take, you know, at least 2 years to build and having to train up American workers. By the way, remember, it is expensive to hire people in America. The salaries are way out of whack with other countries around the Western world. So he has all of these different conflicting economic indicators that are moving at very different paces to his big, full charge ahead trade policy.
And it chimes, doesn't it, with what Paul Danz was saying a moment ago, that after this 100 days, it's almost, quote, a decay, almost like losing a battery life, given what you've said with the midterms coming up next year as well. Also worth saying, Doug, this is a fact that you will like. So since January the 20th, Donald Trump has managed to write 4,149 words a week.
I cited that one this week,
on Truth Social, a newspaper op-ed every single day. Yeah. Elon Musk, by contrast, billionaire with a billion jobs, including at the heart of government, always seems to be walking away slightly from it, up to 21,000 words a week on social media. That is a short novella. That is almost the same as The Strange Case of Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde. Every single
I think
week.
War and Peace, I think he's on the verge of beating War and Peace.
Maybe after a couple of months. Yes.
A couple of months. That's on Truth Social.
And yet.
And he's often, let's remember, the White House often retweets in his name on X, on Musk's platform. So the tweet in which he called himself King, for instance, that was originally on Truth Social, and then it was retweeted on the X platform by the White House. That was the now infamous image of Donald Trump with the crown saying, long live the king.
And yet, early on, we were hearing this kind of constant narrative, weren't we, of foreign affairs. And it was Gaza. It was his contentious plan to evacuate Palestinians to Egypt, to Jordan. And it suddenly, there's like a hot and cold policy as well, isn't there, where you won't hear anything. That was clearly pushed back. But now we're, well, 2 months on from a blockade in Gaza right now, and the UN are screaming that people are suffering, the verge of starvation.
The situation is dire down there, and no one is talking anymore about it. The problem is that on top of it, just this yesterday, Donald Trump on Truth Social was writing about Iran, and he was threatening everybody who would buy oil or anything from Iran of dire consequences. So we are seeing something very escalatory happening in the Middle East, and of course Gaza will be even more forgotten in this situation. You know, everybody was saying, okay, he's a businessman, so he acts like a businessman. Yes, but a corporation is not a democracy. And a corporation is about winning by all means. And when you don't win, you pull back and you go on to another thing. And that's exactly what he's doing. And you have to take that into account into dealing with Trump. And I don't see anyone, even Witkoff, who might now moderate Trump on his views on Iran, being pushed as he is by Netanyahu, but at the same time he's going on with this policy of killing and killing and killing again in Gaza.
Well, one of the inadvertent ripple effects of Trump's first 100 days was evident in events across the border in Canada. The elections on Monday, a victory that seemed a shoo-in for the populist opposition leader, Pierre Poilievre, a conservative who consulted Trump's strategist last year for advice and seemed to have had an unassailable lead. Well, the governing Liberals were said to be in political abyss, written off in January after Trudeau's teary goodbye. Polls suggested that, well, back then only 25% of Canadians could even put a name to the face of Trudeau's successor, the former governor of the Bank of England, Mark Carney. But geopolitics changed the nature of the game. Trump threatened and enforced tariffs in Canada, where 80% of the exports rely on US custom. There was also President Trump's repeated rhetoric on Canada. It should be annexed, made into the American 51st state. So polls changed. Analysts pointed to an unprecedented wave of nationalism. Voters opted for the former banker over the populist. Paul Evra even lost his own seat, while Mark Carney, set to lead a minority government now, has his sights on the Trump negotiations to follow.
One of the responsibilities of government is to prepare for the worst, not hope for the best. As I've been warning for months, America wants our land, our resources, our water, our country. Never. But these are not idle threats. President Trump is trying to break us so that America can own us. That will never, ever happen.
Nina, there is an odd paradox here, isn't there? That all the justifiable fighting talk from Mark Carney over Trump, that you wonder whether there's some glasses raised at Liberal Party HQ to the convenient nemesis next door, said the wrong things at the right time, didn't he?
Absolutely. Look, I mean, the Liberals went into this just 4 months ago, lagging behind in the polls to the tune of more than 20-odd percent. And boy, is Mark Carney, who, by the way, hasn't been a politician up until now. Yes, he's had important politically connected jobs, but he's been a sort of economist at various central banks, not just the British one, but also the Canadian one as well. And he's just shown that he has the common touch in terms of being able to rally people across Canada from all sides of the political spectrum, especially some of the smaller parties as well, saw their support dwindle a bit as people felt, well, look, we just have to vote for the party that's probably going to win and take a strong stance against Donald Trump. As you pointed out before, not just because of the tariffs, but also because, you know, Donald Trump has made it clear that he may well want to try and seize Canada. Mm-hmm. So what's happened here is the incumbent has had an unexpected boost from Trumpian rhetoric from the opponent. And that scenario is likely to play out also in Australia as well, where mm-hmm. we've got another crucial election coming up around the corner. And again, the opposition party is rueing the day that they tried to promise to make Australia great again and to take on board lots of that advice from Trump's top team.
Listen to Nina, Emma. When we were looking at Mark Carney in the background, who was talking about the Trump effect, what do you make of Carney as a leader and what he offers in terms of dealing with Trump and dealing with European leaders too?
Right, well, he's the perfect antidote to Donald Trump, and frankly, it would be hard to find a more qualified leader than Mark Carney to lead a country like Canada at this point in history. He's been the central bank governor of two countries, of Canada and the United Kingdom. He helped both countries come out of the immediate and longer-term effects of the 2008 financial crisis. Trump has met his match in Mark Carney, it would appear, and I did see some commentators on X saying that Trump is spooked by Carney, who apparently he won't say exactly what happened in their phone call, but he made the clear threat that Canada could really, you know, withdraw its holdings in US treasuries as well, just as China and Japan have shown their muscle on this front. And this is, and since then, we're not getting the same kind of rhetoric from Trump about Canada. And in fact, Carney pointed out that Trump had not called him a governor of a state of the United States of America, as he was doing with Trudeau. So I think this Harvard-educated technocrat, who's an excellent speaker, he's got a lot of charisma, knows how to dance much better than Trump, and he knows the world stage. He's been on it for 15, 20 years, dealing with all of the world leaders. They all know him intimately. And in addition, he did this wonderful, it's such a contrast to the social media we hear from Trump and Vance and Musk. He said, you know, he'd spoken with the UN Secretary General, Antonio Guterres, Canada's ready to leave, we'll build coalitions, defend democracy, stand up for our values. And while others step back from global leadership, Canada is stepping up. So that's a message people want to hear in Canada and Australia, my country.
It's a message people want to hear, but it's not a message that goes viral, is it? And probably if we get any comments, the flurry of comments on this programme tonight after this debate will probably be on your suggestion that Carney was a better dancer than Donald Trump, because he has this incredible base to watch all of these images. Doug, The other point to raise on this is, and going back to Nina's comment before, in the UK, she was talking about suddenly the fox in the hen house, Farage's Reform Party splitting two-party politics. There's kind of the converse here, isn't there? You've got the...
Bringing them together.
Yeah, the Liberals and the Conservatives have managed to get 84%
only
of the vote.
Only Trump could do that. Only Trump could do that, right? You know, what's amazing here is... you know, we saw at the very beginning of the show, right, Trump at that rally in Michigan. And at one point after he showed that video of all the deportees, you heard these triumphalist nativist chants, USA, USA, USA. That's sort of a staple of a lot of Trump campaign style rallies. You don't hear Canada, 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 Canada. But he almost has brought out in Canadians, I can only call it this sort of nativism that you just don't see with Canadians, you know. You used to, when I was growing, you know, at school in the U.S. and you'd ask Americans what they thought of Canadians, they'd say, oh, they're just so nice and laid back and reserved. You'd ask Canadians what they think of Americans, they'd go arrogant and loud and obnoxious. And so there was a real dichotomy, but it really is, Trump is managing to bring to the forefront, to the fore, traits that you don't normally associate with, and I guess it goes across the spectrum with a lot of countries, but especially with Canada. Nice, reserved, tolerant people, not judgmental, not bombastically nationalistic.
Which takes us to the Oval Office. 9 weeks ago today, we watched, Anna, you were here at the time as well, but President Zelensky head into the White House. The expectation, the minerals deal would be signed, US access to mine Ukrainian rare earth resources. In exchange, Kyiv would want a security guarantee. The ugly spectacle that the world watched unfold, followed, and President Zelensky left no deal. This week, a Wednesday in Washington, it was President Zelensky's deputy who put pen to paper and signed a new version of that deal alongside the US Treasury Secretary. The Ukrainian team says it's as good as it can get, given the circumstances.
The key here is what is not there. There's no reparations. There is no commitment to pay back previous Biden's support to Ukraine. There is no demand to push money out of Ukraine first for the United States and only then get something for Ukraine. There's no commitment, the sort of the first try, the right of first refusal on all the project. There's no conflict with the EU accession. So, you know, all of those things have been removed.
Anna, this appears to be more, doesn't it, than a critical minerals deal. There's coal, there's oil, there's gas involved as well.
Rare earths. And
what's your take?
Well, of course, it took away the punishing side of the other deals on the table before, punishing Ukraine for the help that the United States have brought it before the Trump administration. But it's still a colonialist deal. I'm sorry for the word, but let's call a spade a spade. It just sets up the framework to exploit natural resources from Ukraine at will from the United States if they can. There is no guarantee of security for Ukraine. I mean, Trump is still saying, well, if you are there, no one dares to touch it. And there is some truth to it, but not entirely to the extent that Trump puts it. There is something interesting on all this dealing with Ukraine. Of course, you will remember Trump, it has been said, but it has to be repeated, Trump was going to end the war in 24 hours with a phone call. And he's pulling away now because he can't, and because indeed the situation is going to unravel in a totally different opposite direction, probably with another attack by Russia this spring or summer. So he doesn't want to lose face, and he's pulling away from it, but pulling away with a deal that might exploit Ukraine. And this is something, I mean, make America great again. The empire, United States, rule the world. Yes, but it looks like an empire, a former empire, you know, going down. This is the image that Trump actually is giving of the United States now. This likes the last convulsions of an empire going under.
Except Zelensky, Vladimir Zelensky didn't portray it in the... I agree that at first the minerals deal did seem extremely colonialist and almost like extortion. But I thought it was interesting the way he framed it. I mean, he said it was a partnership that was a truly equal partnership, creating opportunities for investment, foresees no debt, as we just heard earlier, and this establishment of a reconstruction fund. I mean, I think we should probably also take... you know, at their word, the representatives of Ukraine, who themselves are happy with this, is much better than they expected, in fact, and they negotiated it very well.
I just want to pick up with Doug.
Yes, they did, but I also think there's an element of if you sign it, they will come, meaning the investors. I think there's a lot of wishful thinking on the part. They're trying to will this to work, in a sense, in their rhetoric at least, because, look, let's be honest. The minerals, as we've been saying in reporting this week, are going to take 10 to 20 years to identify, to get past those old Soviet-era maps, to get it out of the ground, to set up the mines, to set up the separation plants, to actually make this well beyond, even if Donald Trump serves a ninth term, it will probably be sometime almost around then that you finally get this. You have to bring the private investors in. This all hinges on future investment, private investment. Who is going to go and set up there in Ukraine right now while there's a war going on? Putin knows very well that, you know, you're not going to have lucrative mining operations and investors rushing into Ukraine at a time where the security risks are still very high. And this is on Russian state TV. I was watching a lot of it this week. They are painting this as a very raw deal for Zelensky. They're saying it's basically almost identical, even if the Ukrainians and Americans are trying to portray it differently. It's almost identical to the original version that Trump imposed on Zelensky back in January, February, which was at the time portrayed as an extortion racket. Basically, you give us $500 billion worth of your minerals to pay back, in quotes, the American taxpayer for all the military aid given under Biden. And in return, we get all of your minerals for free. And by the way, and you get nothing. But that's just the deal. It's a good deal for you, isn't it? Well, no. So the final deal wasn't an extortion racket, but Russian state media still definitely sees it as such. And I'll just add one last thing. Stephen Miller, the notorious, I'll say, ideological advisor, horse whisperer for Donald Trump, also the hardline immigration guy. He writes his speeches.
Prominent in the Oval Office meeting.
You know, accused of being a white supremacist, yeah. All of it. You could add on the whole packet of adjectives there. He himself has said that this is a payback. This is still, essentially, he painted this new deal as payback. The money will be going back to the American taxpayers, which shows that no matter how the Ukrainians want to present this, from the political selling point, the MAGA movement selling point of this deal, they're not going into the nuances of a very fair deal, a 50-50 joint partnership. From their standpoint, they are going to go to those MAGA rallies. At his next rally, I guarantee you, Donald Trump will be telling his people, you're getting your money back.
And yet, I want to bring Nina in for this as well. And Doug, I was doing back of the fact pack at the top of my head mathematics. That will be Make America Great Again, 2052, I think.
2052, sorry, I projected too far.
Nina, let's not forget that it was Kyiv under the Biden administration that put this out
Heaven
to Europe.
Heaven help us, we'll all be retired by then.
maybe. I would have thought so. It was Kyiv, though, back in the Biden administration, wasn't it, that put this out there that said, come and extract, you know, come and work with us, put it out to the EU as well. And I just wonder if you can flip the coin just to listen to that. Kyiv wants security guarantee. Is a security guarantee implicit now that US assets, capital on the ground, might deter future Russian aggression if peace is achieved? What do you think?
Well, if you've got a transactional president like Donald Trump who puts business first, then yes, at the moment, those will be interests that he will be very, very keen to defend. But in 5-10 years' time, or heaven forbid, as you said, in 2052, you have somebody else in charge who believes that other things like, say, you know, defending country sovereignties are more important. Well, you know, the transactional element of the investment there may go out of the window. That's the problem here with this particular deal. Yes, Ukraine is home to about 5% of the world's critical minerals. Donald Trump is obviously, as part of his grand vision, trying to get hold of a chunk of rare earths because he knows that his economic nemesis, China, has been hoarding them for some time. And he needs to secure the supply of those critical elements for the growing telecommunications and Silicon Valley industry that has supported him so much. They will need access to these types of minerals. And so from his point of view, this is giving his base, the big broligarchs and the big technology firms of the world and the MAGA base as well, what they need. But also, as Doug was just pointing out quite rightfully, it gives the Kremlin an opportunity of propaganda here to undermine Zelensky's ability to negotiate, to undermine his democratic mandate, because remember, he was last elected in 2019 and there haven't been any elections since, because obviously Ukraine has been at war with Russia. Yeah. And the Trump administration has made it very clear that they want Zelensky gone. So either side can use this against Zelensky and potentially try and get in a puppet government that is more compliant either to Washington's agenda or to the Kremlin's agenda, or perhaps a bit of both.
It's a very good point. And I should say, just a word, the ceasefire, we'll talk about this next week. May the 8th VE Day in Europe, May the 9th Victory Day in Russia, seen as a PR stunt, Putin announcing this week. Also a word on the ongoing situation in Iran for a French teacher and her partner being held for almost 3 years, coming up to the third year anniversary. Cécile Collet, her partner Jacques Paris, detained in May 2022, accused of spying, seeking to stir up protests, which they deny. A growing concern over their health. And France has repeatedly lobbied for their release. Human rights group this week saying tourists and dual nationals continually held for leverage in diplomatic negotiations. Thank you this evening to my panel. Fantastic insights in a world of complete misinformation. Clarity is hard to come by. So thank you for this week's four distinguished correspondents. In London, presenter, journalist, podcast host of Control Alt Deceit, Nina Dos Santos. And with me here in Paris, Anna Navarro-Pedro. Thank you, Paris-based independent correspondent. Emma Cateson, and Paris-based writer for The New European. Thank you, editor Frank Thireur as well. And Doug Herbert, of course, international affairs commentator of France 24. Thank you all for watching our show. As I say, recognised among the world's top 100 podcasts for current affairs. So join us next Friday, all the biggest stories to come, including, no doubt, discussing the contemplations of the conclave as it begins at the Vatican this coming Wednesday. Who will it be? We'll leave you with a surprise new contender. Place your bets now. We'll see you in 7 days for the world next week.
As Pope? Yeah. I'd like to be Pope. That would be my number one choice.